Americans import more than 90% of our seafood, and much of that imported seafood is farmed. Yet we export a third of what is caught wild within the United States. I'm Joy Cardine. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We will talk with a guest author who says this swap means we're not only downgrading to eating lower quality fish, but we're also ignoring growing threats to our local salmon, shrimp, and other American catches. And we will talk about those threats and why this is happening and what should be done about it this hour. So do you know where your favorite seafood comes from, whether it's imported or local or farmed or wild? And does it matter to you how we get our fish? 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@wpr.org. You can also post on the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page or tweet us at Joy Cardine Show. Our guest is Paul Greenberg, a Pew Fellow in Marine Conservation and also a fellow with the Carl Cecina Center, an author and regular contributor to the New York Times. He is author of the James Beard Award-winning New York Times bestseller, Four Fish, and his most recent book is American Catch, The Fight for Our Local Seafood. Good morning.
Hey, Joy, how are you?
I'm good. So what motivated you to write this book?
Well, I live right near where the old Fulton Fish Market was in New York City. And for you guys out there, I don't know if you're aware of it, but Fulton was at one time the biggest fish market in the world. And I loved being near it. But then one day it just disappeared and they moved it all the way up to the Bronx. And we sort of had the seafood heart cut out of this American city. You know, New York City is an island city and it really should be a seafood city. And we lost our last waterfront market. Mm-hmm. And then it led me into this sort of meditation on what was going on with our seafood supply. And I came to, you know, this very, you know, startling statistic that, you know, the vast majority, you know, more than 85% of our seafood is imported from a lot of it from Asia, very little of it inspected, less than 2% gets inspected by the FDA. But then at the same time, you know, there's fishermen are always sort of complaining about, you know, foreigners undermining their seafood supply. Well, it turns out that's sort of true, but it's also true that fishing companies are exporting a lot of really great wild high omega fish to the same place that are sending the low quality, you know, low omega fish. So it just struck me as a good, you know, set piece around which to build a book.
Oh, it's, and we'll get into the whys too. But so that shrimp po' boy that I had on Saturday night, that shrimp probably did not come from the sparkling waters of the Gulf.
No chance, I would say, if it was an affordable po' boy. You know, shrimp is by far the most consumed seafood in America. We eat 4 pounds, roughly, of shrimp per person, and that is almost more than the next two most popular seafoods combined, salmon and tuna. So, you know, a lot of people eating shrimp, but 90% of the shrimp that we eat is coming to us from abroad. So it's, you know, that's by far probably the largest part of this kind of seafood deficit that you hear talked about.
Yeah, so is it 90% of our shrimp is coming from abroad and it's presumably farmed?
Well, a lot of it's farmed. You know, probably the majority of it is farmed. A lot of it is our biggest shrimp provider is Thailand. And it's funny because, you know, I write about fish all the time. I travel a lot, and I had been doing an article for Prevention magazine a few years ago. And, you know, as usual with health magazines like that, they want to know, you know, well, what is the best shrimp for us to eat, you know, both from a health perspective mm-hmm. and from a environmental perspective. And, you know, I spoke to a lot of people in the seafood world, and everyone agreed that Thailand was by far the best producer. And so I thought, okay, well, that's good. You know, it's our biggest producer, so, you know, great. Well, you know, as this book was coming to press, all this crazy stuff started coming out about Thailand. To begin with, there was a shrimp epidemic that hit Thailand last year called early mortality syndrome, and it wiped out about $1 billion worth of the Thai shrimp crop. So that's, that, you know, when you see disease outbreaks like that, it means the system is really being pushed too hard. Mm-hmm. But then on top of this was this really shocking revelation that The Guardian ran, that it turns out You know, so shrimp, when they're on the farm, are fed other fish. There are fleets of boats that trawl Southeast Asia for what are called trash fish. And then that fish is ground up and turned into fish meal and fed to the shrimp, which is already a little strange, right?
Yeah, it's gross.
It's gross. But then it turns out, though, as The Guardian looked into this whole, you know, sort of subsidiary part of the shrimp industry, that a certain portion of the labor force that was providing those trash fish were slaves. Mm-hmm. That there was actually, you know, slave labor is a common practice, it seems, in that trash fish thing that supplies the Thai industry. So, you know, as you bite into that po' boy, you know, what are you biting into? What are the ethical and environmental compromises you're making when you decide to just kind of default to this very easy choice?
Oh, so I should have had something else.
Well, I think that we shouldn't have so much of shrimp. You know, there's no reason why it should be the number one consumed U.S. seafood by far. You know, just if you look in, so that we're talking about the shrimp farming industry. If you look at the wild shrimp industry, that's also got some issues. You know, shrimp are, well, you know, they're shrimpy, they're little. And when you trawl them, you have to use a very fine meshed net. In the process of dragging a fine mesh net through the water, you catch a lot of other stuff. This is called bycatch, accidentally killed fish that are a result of the shrimp fishery. So when you trawl a shrimp net through shrimp, you're going to get generally at least 2 pounds of unwanted fish for every pound of shrimp that you catch. And in some industries, outside of the United States, which have poor regulations, that can be 3 pounds, 4 pounds, 5 pounds, sometimes as much as 8 pounds of, you know, unwanted stuff that's killed to put that shrimp on your po' boy. So, again, you know, I'm not opposed to shrimp. I do think there are shrimpers in the Gulf that I've worked with that I think, you know, are ethically minded and do good things. But if we demand 4 pounds of shrimp per person per year, we're going to stress the world out.
Yeah, so, and it was a rare po' boy, by the way, but in any case.
I know, I'm not, no. I don't want to bust your chops.
I know, but it is, so I'm wondering why this is, that we are depending on, I know that, so demand is part of it, is that we, yeah. But there's not enough shrimp in the Gulf for us to satisfy that need. That's why so much of it comes from Thailand.
That's true, and, you know, I think, though, that what we've created is kind of a nonsensical demand. You know, Americans generally are not very fishy people. I know in Wisconsin, do they still in Wisconsin have like a fish fry, you know, on
Friday
night?
Oh, you bet. Yeah, and it is, it used to be like Michigan, you know, perch, but more and more it's cod.
Cod or even tilapia probably.
Yeah, maybe, but for the fish fry, it's cod is a more popular choice, yeah.
Yeah, well, so right there is a really interesting thing, right? So you say it used to be Midwestern perch. One of the things that this country is completely oblivious to is the loss of commercial freshwater fisheries.
Right.
You know, Wisconsin, all the states surrounding the Great Lakes, once upon a time were, you know, if not fully reliant, you know, certainly a huge chunk of their seafood came from your local resources. We've done a really bad job with our freshwater fisheries. We've overfished them in some regards, but, you know, huge issue is just pollution and also the effect that agriculture has on fish populations. You know, the amount of fertilizer that's causing these algal blooms in the Great Lakes and in smaller bodies of water is, I think, you know, unnaturally depressing the amount of freshwater fish we could be eating. And, you know, just as another aside, I mentioned at the top of the hour that I live near the Fulton Fish Market. I found out through some research that there was at one point within the Fulton Fish Market an entire city block that was devoted to only American freshwater fish. So think about that. You know, there was a net export of freshwater fish from the Midwest at one point. What happened to that? Why isn't that a critical part of our seafood supply anymore?
Yeah, and I let's talk about that. But I also want to talk about why is it that a third of what is caught wild within the United States being shipped elsewhere?
It's, you know, so there are two things going on. One is that seafood exporters understand that Americans don't like fish that much, much to their detriment. We eat about 200 pounds of, you know, what I call land food, of land food protein, industrially produced beef, pork, chicken, lamb. But we only eat 15 pounds of seafood per person per year, in spite of the fact that, you know, the FDA and the EPA has just told us to up that amount. Well, if you have Americans generally not liking seafood that much, there are other countries that like it a whole lot better and have, surprise, lower rates of obesity and heart disease. So Japan, Korea, China, these are all countries that eat 35, 40 pounds of seafood a year, and they're more than happy to take off our hands the really high omega, flavorsome fish that Americans spurn. Like, have you ever had a fish called a black cod? It's not the cod that you have in a fish fry, but it's a different kind of fish.
I have, yes. It was good.
Yeah, so it's a great, great fish. It has nothing actually taxonomically to do with what they call a true cod that you have in your fish fries. But a black cod is a very high in omega-3s. It's a deep water fish. We have lots and lots and lots of it. And most of it goes abroad. It's kind of crazy. The other thing that goes on, though, is a more pernicious and harder-to-see thing is what's called re-importing. So, you know, you probably eat salmon a fair amount, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, from time to time, yeah.
Yeah, so our wild Alaska salmon, a certain portion of it gets caught in American waters, frozen, sent to China, defrosted, boned, filleted, refrozen a second time, and sent back to us. Double frozen.
Why?
Well, it's the almighty buck
yeah.
To some degree. I mean, I was looking into this recently for an article I did for the LA Times about the squid industry, because actually this is a huge issue with squid as well. Like Californians, you can be on a dockside in Southern California and, you know, be sitting next to a fishing boat that caught your squid. But meanwhile, the squid on your plate, you know, went from that boat on a processor to China and came back and to get to your plate. So 12,000 miles before the boat next door could get the squid on your plate. But anyway, so, I mean, in the squid industry, they found that looking at the economics of it, they're saving about $1.50 a pound to process in China because the labor is so cheap. But again, you have to ask yourself, you know, what are the ethical issues around that? Like, do you really, couldn't you pony up another $1.50 a pound so that you weren't getting, you know, food processed in a, you know, questionable food system by laborers who are getting a fraction of what Americans would get paid.
We are talking with Paul Greenberg. He is the author of American Catch, The Fight for Our Local Seafood. We're talking about where our seafood comes from in this country, where we're sending our wildly caught seafood, and what's going on here? Why this is? Why are we importing more than 90% of our seafood, exporting a third of what is caught wild within the United States to other countries? And why does it matter? 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@wpr.org. You can also post on the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page. Does it matter to you how you get your fish, as long as you get it from somewhere? Let us know your questions and concerns. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network. We are talking about the fight for local seafood with Paul Greenberg, who is the author of American Catch. And we are welcoming your questions for him at 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@wpr.org. You can also post on the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page. Well, let's share a comment from Buzz on Facebook. He says, this has to do with pocketbooks, especially here in Wisconsin. While we love wild salmon, we often buy farm-raised just because of the cost. We never buy tilapia and will only buy Gulf shrimp, but they do have a high cost too. So it's the consumer's pocketbook that is determining a lot of this too, Paul Greenberg?
It is. But it also has to do with sort of choices we've made on an institutional level. You know, one of the things in the book is about this fight for what is the largest sockeye salmon run in the world. It's in Bristol Bay, Alaska. And right now there's a discussions of citing what would be the largest copper mine in North America pretty much right next to the spawning grounds of that really amazing fish. Well, you look at that fish, about half of it is going abroad at this point. And my argument is that because we don't have, you know, economic institutions like, say, you know, what if the Wisconsin public university system were to source salmon from Bristol Bay rather than sourcing it from, you know, a fish farming company or from Cisco or from wherever. We just seem to kind of go in the direction of what is easiest. And, you know, it's true that farm salmon is cheaper. And I don't think there's necessarily, you know, I don't think farm salmon is necessarily bad. But if we have wild American salmon that we are not using in this country, shouldn't we make use of it? And shouldn't we sort of support the environment that is required to have all this great wild fish with our own pocketbooks? I think we can achieve economies of scale if enough people get on board with it and if institutions get on board of it. But, I mean, I think most people are just kind of blind to it. They don't even know that it's happening.
Let's take a call. Camille in Frankfort, Michigan. Hello, Camille.
Hi. This is a great topic for you to have this morning. I really love seafood. I live on the Michigan side of the lake, and the reason why I hesitate to eat more of it is because I don't have a source of what is safe to eat. And I'm wondering where I can get that information, especially for the freshwater fish, the lakes and the rivers.
Excellent question. And I should point out that this is actually another issue of where we've let sort of land food and land priorities take precedent over a healthier food system that we could have. I mean, why is it that we have to even worry about the safety of our seafood system? I mean, who made that decision? Why do we have to worry about mercury and other pollutants in inland seafood? And we do. You know, we really do. I mean, we've coal-fired plants dump tons and tons of mercury into our food systems every year. And, you know, you often think that, oh, it's only the ocean somehow that's getting polluted, but it's actually freshwater bodies can often have more pollutants in them than saltwater bodies. Anyway, though, getting back to your immediate question of how can you find seafood that is, you know, that is you know, safe for you to eat, generally speaking, if you go lower on the food chain, you're going to have a lower level of contaminants. So sardines, anchovies, squid, these are all things that have high omega-3s but low levels of contaminants. And as far as seafood from your individual lakes, you know, the best place I've found is that state departments of environmental conservation often give health advisories, and they're directed more at sport fishermen than they are at consumers, but they will issue you warnings about the number of portions of individual fish per each water body. And if they don't do that, then you ought to write them a letter. I know that the Maryland DEC, for example, has a very detailed description of what you can eat when from different water bodies. Every state should really be tracking this. And, you know, finally, it's just if you're finding that your local seafood supply is not in good shape, I mean, this is where we really need to take action. I mean, our water should be clean enough to eat from. You know, we have a Clean Water Act. We have a Clean Air Act. We need to get busy making our seafood system safer and better for us.
Yeah. Thank you very much, Camille, for the call. It reminded me of, to some extent, the fish boil that I just had in Door County. We do have a whitefish that is locally used in those fish boils in Door County off Lake Michigan or in out of Lake Superior. So
now, I haven't heard of a fish boil before.
You haven't?
Oh, no, I haven't.
You've got to go to a fish boil. I don't know. It's some Norwegian custom or something. I'm not sure where they throw potatoes and onions and whitefish into a big pot and they boil it, and they actually, there's a big show for the tourists where they'll burn off the oil that comes up from the whitefish boiling, and they'll throw some kerosene and a flame onto this kettle, and then there's a huge like fire that occurs. But in any case, you got to try one of those. But I guess I just brought it up because it's a situation where we are eating local, the local fish. But the concern still remains because there's PCBs and all these other things in those in the Great Lakes. And boy, they've been there for years. It's kind of hard to say let's just clean that up, right? I mean, it's there.
It is hard to say. I mean, we do have these, you know, what are called POP, persistent organic pollutants, and they're going to be there for some time. You know, with something like a whitefish, you know, it depends water body to water body, but again, the whitefish does eat fairly low on the food chain,
mm-hmm.
so it's probably not going to pose the risk as, say, some of those transplanted king salmon that you have in the lakes there. You know, it's a tricky question, but I think that what we need to do is to loop, rather than just sort of forget about these food systems as being, you know, something that we've lost, let's look into why we've lost them. And there are other things that are threatening the remaining fisheries that we have. I mean, there in the Midwest, you have a real issue with excess phosphorus coming off of farms that are causing algal blooms, which in turn cause anoxic areas called dead zones. And I know in Lake Erie, this is a really, really serious problem of just too much phosphorus getting into the water and affecting those fisheries. This is something we can do something about. It's not something that, you know, is going to stay there forever. But again, because people are not really focused on fisheries, they're focused more on agriculture, the emphasis isn't there to really put some financial muscle behind those kind of regulations.
Yeah. Dave emails, in Wisconsin, there are dire health warnings against eating any fish from our polluted waters. I wouldn't swim in Wisconsin lakes, much less eat fish from them. In the oceans, fish populations are declining rapidly. Continued harvest is a recipe for mass extinction and collapse. And my understanding is most farmed fish are loaded with toxic substances and should be avoided. It's obvious we need to get real about the fish crisis. And it begins with education. Well,
whoa.
Yeah. Well, so maybe.
That's quite a broadside.
There's a lot going on here. Maybe we shouldn't eat fish at all, Paul Greenberg.
I disagree. And also, you know, so I think that the writer's comments, you know, they're good ones to have out there, but we have to get a little more fine scale. First of all, let's look at the overfishing issues. Yes, there is a lot of overfishing going on in the world. But the United States in the last 20 years has really, really improved its fisheries management to the point where we have rebuilt over, I think, 30 different wild fish and shellfish stocks in the last 20 years. This is the result of, there was an add-on to the main fisheries legislation that we use called the Sustainable Fisheries Act in 96, and it mandated the rebuilding of every single American fish stock. Now, different levels of success have been achieved. You know, Atlantic cod, not so much. Haddock doing pretty well. You can't make a blanket statement like that. And I would further argue that we do want to eat American seafood rather than foreign wild seafood, because a third of the wild seafood that we import, and, you know, we import a lot of wild seafood, don't get me wrong, but a third of that is caught illegally, it turns out. You know, management of fisheries is really key. You know, managers go out there, they try to figure out the number of fish that are out there and the number of fish that we can catch. If that kind of system is not put in place, it's basically theft. And as I said, you know, more than 30% of what we're importing from the wild is illegally caught. So you really should be eating American seafood. Now, on the issue of, you know, of local pollution and, you know, the warnings against eating fish from our local lakes, yeah, that is a serious, serious slap in the face and wake-up call to our regulators. I mean, nobody seems to just kind of, I mean, people should take this seriously. I mean, we've destroyed a food system in our freshwater lakes and rivers, and we can get it back, we can figure it out, but it needs to be made a real priority, and especially since seafood increasingly seems to be linked to our health, I mean, we need to demand that our local seafood resources be, you know, in better shape than they are. Should I keep going? There was another question about farm seafood. Yeah, so the last thing was about farm seafood and that most of farm seafood is tainted. Again, a little bit too blanket to be totally true. I do think that foreign farm seafood is poorly inspected, like less than 2% of the seafood that we get from abroad is getting any kind of inspection at all. So that needs to be increased. But I do think that there are ways and means of doing really good aquaculture in our country. The United States currently ranks 15th in fish farming and aquaculture, it's called. We're just behind Egypt and Myanmar, you know, if you think of that, like what a pathetic state that's in. Well, you know, we can do good aquaculture, particularly when it comes to things like mussels, which are very high in omega-3s, oysters, clams. But in order for us to get aquaculture going into this country, we actually really need to make a push for it, and we need to empower coastal communities to get waterfront access, which, frankly, the very wealthy in this country are hogging and not allowing to be the food systems that they should be.
Interesting. Andy in Appleton is with us. Hello, Andy.
Good morning, Paul and Joy. I was always excited when a grocery shop is when fish is on sale. And inevitably, it's sourced from China, which I have a trust issue about. I'm seeing more labeling for a particular sea it comes from than a country, so it's a little harder for me to say I trust or don't trust the food supply. And Fukushima also has me a little worried what comes over in the form of sushis. But the big question is are we spurring a need here for more fish farms in Wisconsin and surrendering the hope that we can have good food from our local supply in fresh waters?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, it's a good question because, you know, once you get aquaculture going, it erases the deficit that we should be actually seeing because we're not taking care of our wild resources. So you have to figure out a way that people can kind of constantly be reminded that there is a wild seafood supply out there. I think in the case of, like, for example, I make the argument in the book that Pebble Mine, which is this huge mine they want to put next to the largest sockeye salmon run on Earth, that one of the reasons we don't seem to even be paying attention to that is that we have so much farmed salmon coming into this country that we kind of figure, well, comes from Alaska, comes from Chile, comes from Norway. We don't really care too much. And, you know, it's, to me, this book, American Catch, is kind of a manifesto. You know, it's a kind of meant to be a wake-up call to, hey, where is this vital component of our seafood supply? Where is it on my plate, and how do I get it? And if it's not there, how do I demand that things change so that I can get it? So, you know, consider it something of an opening salvo to what I hope will be something of a campaign that will go on over the next couple of years to try and really get us to pull our heads out of the mud and look around and see what are our seafood resources, what can we do to rebuild them, and what should we demand of our local environment to provide good quality local wild seafood for us.
Thank you, Andy, for the call. Next we go to Gene in Oshkosh. Hello, Gene.
Good morning, Joy. Good morning, guest. This has haunted me for a while. I thought I liked scallops. Mm-hmm. And then someone said, if the piece is symmetrical, they're all round or they're all square, you're not getting scallops at all, you're getting shark meat. Would you make a comment on that, please?
Well, certainly seafood fraud is very common in this country. Oceana, a nonprofit, did a report where they found anywhere from 20 to 70% of seafood in restaurants is mislabeled and doesn't even bear the correct species name. It depends how far from the ocean you're getting, whether or not you're getting shark meat. But what I can tell you is this. So there are two kind of basic rubrics of scallops in the marketplace. There are bay scallops and sea scallops. Sea scallops are generally wild. They're coming, a lot of them from America, because actually, you know, because of really improved management, New Bedford, which is one of the major ports for U.S. scallops, is now the most profitable port in America. But unfortunately, a lot of those sea scallops are getting exported, those really lovely, wild, big sea scallops. Bay scallops, on the other hand, this is a very interesting story. So bay scallops have been domesticated, and a lot of them are farmed. But in 1982, a Chinese aquaculture scientist came to Martha's Vineyard, you know, the resort island where Obama and the Clintons vacationed. Mm-hmm. And when he was visiting, he visited a pond called Tisbury Pond and found scallops growing there that, you know, they were domesticated scallops. And so he was offered to take back 120 scallops back to China, which he did. Along the way, most of them died, but 26 survived, and they put them into the bays around Qingdao, and became a multi-million dollar Chinese scallop industry. And it's a huge, huge industry in China now, and a certain portion of those Martha's Vineyard originating but Chinese-grown scallops are now exported back to us in the United States.
Well, you also you do write a lot about the oysters that we used to harvest in the waters, even in the New York City area.
Yep.
What does it matter if we are no longer cultivating those nearby?
Yeah, so New York City used to be basically the oyster capital of the world. The average New York City resident up until about 1920 ate 600 local New York City oysters per person per year. So a lot of oysters. And actually, New York City was a net exporter of oysters. And at one point, our total oyster harvest in this country is about 2 billion pounds, equivalent in per capita consumption of what we do per capita consumption of foreign shrimp per year. So getting back to your question, what we've really done is we've traded our local estuaries, our local, you know, seafood-producing engines for estuaries, you know, halfway around the world. What that does is that once we disconnect ourselves from our own estuaries, from the places that produce wild seafood for us, we really let them go to pot. And if you look at the story of New York City, you know, by about 1900, we were dumping 600 million gallons of raw sewage into New York City waters every day. Once those seafood sources got polluted by all that and people started getting sick, then we gave up on it as a food system altogether. And that's when we started really putting in the bad stuff, heavy metals, Agent Orange. You remember the defoliant that was sprayed all over forest canopies in Vietnam? Well, it was actually manufactured in New York City, and dioxins were dumped right into the water and polluted our local oyster resources. Ironically, now we're sort of double messing up Vietnam from that Agent Orange incident. We sprayed all this Agent Orange all over the forest canopies in Vietnam, ruined a lot of mangrove forests, which are critical to seafood production. And now a lot of those mangrove forests have been converted into shrimp ponds, which are really damaging to the environment, and we're importing tons and tons of shrimp from Vietnam, so we're sort of double messing up Vietnam. First, we ruined their forest canopies through Agent Orange, and now we're messing them up by really overtaxing their systems by taking too many shrimp.
We're talking about the fight for our local seafood with Paul Greenberg, author of American Catch. He's also author of the James Beard Award-winning New York Times bestseller, For Fish. And we are welcoming your questions for him. We're welcoming your reactions and views on this. Do you know where your favorite seafood comes from, whether it's imported or if it's local, whether it's farmed or whether it's wild? Did you know that we import more than 90% of our seafood? Much of it's farmed, and we export a third of what is caught wild within the United States? 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@wpr.org. You can also post on the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We are talking about American seafood and the fight to save American seafood with Paul Greenberg, author of American Catch. 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@wpr.org. Our next caller is Mike in Green Bay. Hello, Mike.
Hi. Good morning. I'm glad you mentioned Door County because I wanted to ask for something of a regional, a Midwestern catch. Since Wisconsin is surrounded by Lake Superior, the most clean freshwater lake in the world, as well as Lake Michigan, I'd like to see your author or somebody else take a little bit more focus on Midwestern. There is a unique fish on the tip of Door County, which on Washington Island they serve. It's technically a turbot, but they call it lawyers. And there's one restaurant on the whole island, and I think in the whole state, that serves deep-fried lawyers. And it's a local joke because people have never heard of the fish before. but it's using something of a, you know, a wasted fish in Lake Superior, and I think something like that should be at least publicized in Wisconsin and other Midwestern states, because we do have resources that we don't, we're not aware of.
Thanks, I think it's an excellent, excellent point. There, as I said earlier, freshwater fish were key to this country at one point. And if you look at some of our New York City menus from the 19th century, you'll see all sorts of freshwater fish, some of it from the Midwest. It is, I think, a national, should be a regional priority to really, really think about some of these local fish. You know, as I say, Lake Whitefish is a great, great fish that you have throughout the Great Lakes region. I have to say, you know, as a person who covers the ocean and seafood in general, that there are many fish in the sea, and you don't always get to be able to go in situ with every single fish out there. But I'm hoping actually to look more into Midwestern fish. We're actually going to be doing a workshop with the Minneapolis Zoo in the fall. And Joy, I can send you info on that as it comes up. But we're going to bring in people from Sea Grant, from some local fishermen, and we're going to have a big symposium at the zoo where we're going to discuss what are the local seafood options and what are the ways that we can increase those fish in our you know, Midwestern food supply. I mean, part of the problem is we have delocalized our food system to such an extent that it's hard to get some of these local fish to market, and it's much easier, say, for a restaurant to call up Sysco or one of the large food providers and say, you know, I got to, you know, fill 3,000 plates of seafood next week. Can I get a delivery of just some fish that we can use to fill all that? Well, of course, they're not going to go to Lake Superior and get that fish. They're going to just source it in the easiest way they can, and a lot of times it's sourcing it from China. We've had a local land food in this movement for 10 or 15 years now. I really think it's time for a local seafood movement. It's going to take a lot of thought. It's going to take a lot of effort. It's going to take a lot of publicity to happen, but I think we would be a healthier and better nation if we were to have that kind of movement going.
And then you can, when you're in Minneapolis, maybe they can find some deep-fried lawyers for you to try.
No, that would be great. I would love to try it. Have you had that, Joy?
I've heard of it, and we've actually talked briefly about it on this show, but more in terms of you know, funny things to do, tourism-type things to do, not so much as reviving the local fishing industries. But what about his, when he says, you know, we've got the pristine Lake Superior and the... and Lake Michigan, I mean, are the Great Lakes, you know, those two lakes, good in terms of can we eat fish out of those lakes with abandon?
You can. I mean, I think you always have to be worried about what are called larger trophic level fish. Mm-hmm. So, you know, the king salmon, as I say, are going to be an issue because larger fish do what's called bioconcentrating pollutants. You know, the little fish. You know, the way it goes is you go from phytoplankton to zooplankton to little fish to big fish to even bigger fish. And every time food moves up the food chain, toxics remain in the body of whatever ate them. So that a king salmon that's eating, say, I don't know, an alewife that ate zooplankton and so forth, mm-hmm. is going to carry the load, the whole eating history of all the other little creatures that were eaten along the way. Like whitefish... as I mentioned, you know, eat fairly low. They're a zooplankton eater, and so they're less likely to contain toxics and contaminants. And even though, you know, so Lake Superior is a relatively pristine of the, you know, relatively clean lake compared to the other Great Lakes, but the problem is every lake is going to bear the burden of coal-fired plants and the mercury they produce. So, you know, you can, you know, do all you want to protect the watershed from, you know, bad water flowing into the lake, but it's hard to screen them from the air, which is another reason, you know, I think there's a positive feedback loop here. If we all of a sudden were to say, whoa, our lakes are getting polluted by coal, let's do something about this coal issue, because we're getting sick from it. Our fish are getting sick from it. Let's try and figure out some way where we can either scrub that mercury out of the coal or figure out some other kind of pollution, energy system.
Sally in Madison is with us now. Hi, Sally.
Hi, thank you. Both for this very interesting show. My husband has a severe allergy to penicillin, and several years ago in Massachusetts, we went to eat at a restaurant where he ordered fish, and he had his penicillin reaction of hives breaking out on his neck.
Oh, interesting.
And it turned out the fish was locally farmed, and although the owner assured us that it was completely wonderful farming, it's probably likely that the seafood that had been ground up to feed the fish probably most likely had penicillin in it, which I thought was an interesting secondary effect that's not known, but it certainly made the most sense.
Yeah.
One other thing I didn't include in asking, but I thought of, was the Monterey Fish Aquarium, the Monterey Aquarium's list of good seafood or not, and if
yeah.
you could comment on that. Thank you.
Sure. Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, great question. I mean, it's a rare caller that throws a total curveball at me, but that's really interesting, a penicillin mm-hmm. reaction from an American farmed fish. I can only speculate, but it's possible that the feed that was fed to the fish that your husband ate might have come from processed farmed salmon byproducts. Farmed salmon byproducts usually make it more into the commodities chain and are fed to things like pigs and chicken and to pets. Actually, a certain amount of pet food comes from farmed salmon byproducts. But I suppose it's possible. And, you know, as far as antibiotics use on the farms, they do, you know, there are, you know, shipments from abroad do get flagged for having antibiotics in them. I know that Chile had a huge outbreak in their farm salmon of what was called infectious salmon anemia back in the late aughts. And, you know, certainly it's an issue in farm seafood around the world. Now, the other question about the Monterey Bay Aquarium's Seafood Watch program, that's a very interesting, good program. It's run by the aquarium. It was actually one of two organizations that started this idea that consumers needed to know more about the sustainability of their seafood, started in the late 90s. And now, Seafood Watch, Monterey Bay Aquarium Seafood Watch, has combined their standards with the East Coast version, which had been the Blue Ocean Institute. Now it's called the Carl Safina Center, which I'm a fellow. And they have a single standard for sustainability, and they rank fish, whether they're red, avoid, yellow, you know, okay, and green, always good to eat. In addition, Monterey Bay Aquarium also has what's called their super green list, which not only tells you their sustainability factors, but also tells you whether they're, you know, super green fish also has acceptable levels of pollutants in them or very, very low levels so that you can always feel safe eating them.
Mm-hmm. Thanks again for the call. We have somebody who also wanted to know what you thought about the Monterey Bay fish guy, Jim, in an email, but he also asked, we have been buying a fish named Swy. Can you talk about this fish at all?
Swy, oh yes, very interesting. So Swy is kind of known in the industry as Pangasius catfish, and it was originally just sold here as catfish because it had a similar mouthfeel, and a lot of southern people just got slotted into the role that catfish played. So Pangasius catfish are extremely fast-growing, and you can really cram them into a pond because if the pond runs out of oxygen at a certain point, these fish can stick their mouths above the water and breathe air. It's just kind of creepy. But, you know, from an ecological point of view, it is a very efficient fish and not a bad thing to farm. But anyway, so the catfish growers here in this country actually sued Vietnam for more or less a trademark infringement by calling them catfish. Then they rebranded them in this country as one of the two species of Pangasius that are grown. There was a traw and a bassa that were put out there. Then those market names didn't hold on, and now they've decided to rebrand them again as Swy. So it's a very, very neutral fish. It's actually the sixth most consumed fish in America.
Really?
I always say that you end up in a hospital and the orderly comes by and says, what would you like, chicken or fish? And you say, what's the fish? And the orderly will say, I don't know, it's fish. Well,
that's
going to be Swy.
That's interesting. Well, you know, speaking of, I forgot all about this. Renee on Facebook posts, we have a new locally grown shrimp farm here in Vernon County, Westby.
Yeah.
They will be harvesting their first batches in August. What is your opinion on this for safety and sustainability?
I think it's fantastic. I mean, you know, shrimp really should be a sustainable choice because when you think about it, they grow really fast. They're omnivorous, so you can feed them a lot of different things, and probably we could come up with a diet for them that wouldn't involve slave labor and trash fish fishing. And I know of a bunch of small shrimp farms that are popping up around the country. There's some going on in Illinois, happening in Alabama. I would love to see these small-scale, what are called containment shrimp farms that can be set up close to markets. I mean, I even remember hearing a graduate student sent me her undergraduate or graduate thesis, which was a sort of cool idea, which is, you know, as Detroit continues to have, you know, implosions of its industrial sector, well, there are these huge warehouses that are just sitting there empty, factories and so forth. Well, they would make great indoor fish farms. So why not do that? You know, what a cool thing that would be.
Yeah, then I can have my next pull boy can have the Vernon County shrimp on it, maybe.
Yeah, yeah, please, yeah. Please do that.
Kathy emails, wild-caught salmon costs in excess of $16 a pound. How many people can afford that when compared to chicken or beef?
Well, when compared to chicken or beef, seafood in general is a expensive choice. Even like tilapia regularly is at about $8 a pound. Compare that to chicken, you know, and you've got a considerable difference. There are ways to get wild salmon into your diet. For example, I always think of like canned salmon. So canned tuna is the number two most consumed seafood in America. Well, canned salmon is just a little bit more expensive. It's not radically more expensive. It's higher, it's not higher in omega-3s, depending on the species that you get. It also is much easier to, from an environmental standpoint, manage wild salmon than it is tuna. Tuna range over a huge, huge territory. They're coming to us from many, many countries, whereas wild Alaska salmon comes to us from Alaska, and there's very good management. You can do everything with canned salmon that you can do with canned tuna. You got to get used to some of the products have skin and bone in them, but those actually dissolve if you, you know, do it into a salmon salad. And I think it's an excellent choice to make if you want to get more wild salmon into your diet.
Oh, Larry from Muscadet emails, this program is painting a rather bleak picture. Is there any hope?
Well, I don't think it's a bleak picture. Mm-hmm. It's just a confusing picture. I mean, the hope is that we're sending a third of our seafood abroad. Let's mm-hmm. not do that. Let's keep our seafood at home. Here's another hopeful thing, I mean, that I mentioned earlier. 30 stocks of fish, wild fish, have been rebuilt in this country in the last 20 years. We've had tremendous success with rebuilding our wild seafood. It's just that, you know, like when Michael Pollan wrote Omnivore's Dilemma, you know, it was like all of a sudden Americans woke up like, oh my gosh, there's a really serious problem with our land food production. And we did it. And, you know, all sorts of different things happened. Organic food became much more common and the price went down. You know, grass-fed beef became much more common and the price went down. We can change this dynamic, but we have to want to change it, and we have to really embrace seafood as kind of a national tradition that should be a core part of our values.
Good food for thought. Thanks very much, Paul.
Thank you, Joy.
Paul Greenberg, author of American Catch, The Fight for Our Local Seafood. Thanks to Christy Taylor, to Bill Martins, and to Justin Williams for producing this program. Thank you for listening. I hope you stay tuned. There's much more to come, including tomorrow at this time. It's On Your Money. Financial planner Kevin McKinley will be in with answers to your personal finance questions. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network.